Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Ogletree Deacons Employment Law Podcast. My name is Bud Bobber. I'm a lawyer in the Ogletree Deacons office in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I'm joined today by one of my favorite colleagues here in the Milwaukee office, Keith Coplin. Keith, how you feeling?
I'm doing well, Bud. How are you?
I'm good. And today we're going to talk about wage and hour issues. Are you up for that?
Happy to do it. One of my favorite topics, Bud.
I thought it might be. And we're going to bring a little focus to it, too, because wage and hour law is vast, to say the least. It starts with the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is the federal law that applies to most every employer in the country. And that's a complicated law with dozens and dozens of chapters of regulations in addition to the statute itself. But wage and hour law gets even more complicated by that because there's an extensive mix of state and local laws that govern employers and the rights of employees regarding their wages and their work hours. And we're just not able to, in a podcast, cover all aspects of applicable state law. So one word to the wise to all employers is to always be mindful of your local law, your state law, in addition to the general federal law, because as a general proposition, employees are entitled to receive the most beneficial wage law that applies to them, whether it's state or federal. We're also going to bring some focus to this discussion because we were going to talk about manufacturers and the particular wage and hour issues that seem to be more recurring themes for manufacturers, mainly because of the nature of the factory as a workplace. So with that introduction, let's jump right into it. And we're going to start with really the most seemingly basic but surprisingly complicated concept, which is what type of employee activity is deemed to be compensable work that an employer has to pay for? Keith?
That's a really good question. And part of that, if you think about the context behind the Fair Labor Standards Act, it was passed in the 1930s and its intent was to provide a minimum wage rate and a maximum work week and some child labor protections for folks who are engaged in interstate commerce. That's a very broad definition. So if you think about the different businesses that can be encompassed by that, work is going to look a little different in each of those establishments. So the statute literally says employ means to suffer or permit to work. It means you require it or you allow it to happen. But that, of course, begs the question, what is work in the first place? And so there were cases early on, Supreme Court decisions that were interpreting what that meant to be engaged in work. And one of the early cases said, literally, it's physical or mental exertion, whether burdensome or not, that is controlled and required by the employer and pursued necessarily for the employer's benefit. Very broad definition, but the key there is it's controlled time that is required by the employer and pursued for the employer's benefit. And that's really still the definition today of what it means to be engaged in quote unquote compensable work activities.
And Keith, in most factories, the hourly employees are on a schedule. And in terms of defining their paid work time, how relevant is the scheduled time?
The schedule is not going to be controlling when it comes to the compensable work day. If you think about it, sometimes people might start work early. And they might be doing activities that aren't necessarily directly related to the things for which they were hired. So the shift itself isn't going to be governing somebody's claim later on that they weren't paid for all of their quote unquote work activities. So the regulations are clear and the cases are clear that work can start before the shift and it can continue after the shift. It really does depend on whether it's work as defined by those cases.
And sometimes I know that employers talk about not paying for activities that really only take a few minutes of time here and there. And we know that as the de minimis doctrine in wage law. What's the what's the state of the law in terms of what the de minimis doctrine really means these days?
Now, the de minimis doctrine is something that was basically founded in a Supreme Court decision. And what the court held, this is back in the 1940s, the court held that certain periods of time are only a few seconds here and there, and it's just too difficult to record that. And those periods of time can be disregarded, so said the court back in the 1940s. One of the issues that has emerged is, as technology has continued to advance and you've got time clocks built into some pieces of equipment, it's harder and harder for employers to argue that it's too difficult to record that time. And so if there's time that occurs on a regular basis, even if it's a small amount of time, if we can record it and capture that with our timekeeping systems, it's difficult to argue that it's something that should be disregarded from the compensable workday.
There are some things that employees do, particularly in the context of a factory work environment, that isn't necessarily paid work time. So let's talk about some of those. One that I'll start with is walking time. You know, the employee has to get him or herself to the factory for work and has to get from the front door, probably through the front office area or some other entrance area, and walk through the factory to get to their workstation. If the factory is big enough, you know, that can take a couple minutes in and of itself. And that walking time, just by itself, that's not necessarily time that the employer has to pay for. Is that right?
That's correct. Standing alone, the walking time at the beginning of a shift and at the end of a shift wouldn't be compensable. It's just like commuting to the facility in the morning. That isn't compensable either. There can be a wrinkle there if the employee performs a compensable work activity to start the day. At that point, there's something called the continuous workday rule. And what that basically means is from the first compensable work activity through until the last compensable work activity, that entire period should be paid, including the walking that might occur during the day.
And also, Keith, sometimes employees in a factory are required to wait to work. And whether they're waiting for a time clock to become available to use, or they're waiting to go through a security a checkpoint of some sort, those waiting times aren't necessarily compensable either, are they?
No, they're not. Just like the walking time would not be compensable. Somebody shows up and they sit in the break room before the start of their shift. That time as they wait for the shift to start would not be compensable.
So I'd like to shift gears, because both of us work with plenty of manufacturers and see these issues and follow them in the case law. And I want to identify these for our listeners. A big wage and hour problem that I see for manufacturers involves so-called off-the-clock work issues, where they get sued on a claim that employees were required to participate in certain types of activities that weren't captured on paid time on the time clock, and then the employer has to defend against those. So why don't you start and identify some form of off-the-clock work issue you've seen that hits manufacturers?
One of the biggest ones that I've seen lately is the pre- and the post-shift work activity that isn't necessarily the activity for which the employee was hired. It's not operating the machine, but it might be maintaining the machine. It's not working on production. It's getting dressed, putting on protective equipment. Those sorts of preliminary and post-preliminary activities can be compensable. They're closely related to the principal activity that the employee is hired to perform. So again, we mentioned that the shift isn't necessarily the start of the day to the end of the day. It can be earlier depending upon the activities that employees might be asked to perform.
Yeah, in fact, I've seen some manufacturers require employees to have a shift handoff meeting with the workers on the prior shift. So perhaps they each work 8.5 hour shifts, and there's 3 8.5s that go around the clock, and you'll always have that half hour of overlap. But I've seen employers that require the shift handoff meeting before somebody's paid work time starts, and that can be a problem. Another recurring theme, right along the lines of what you talked about pre-shift activities, is so-called donning and doffing, a term familiar to many, but not everyone. So what's donning and doffing?
Donning and doffing is putting on and taking off clothing and protective equipment that is required to do the job. So it can be putting on and taking off safety glasses or maybe hearing protection, white uniforms or smocks. It can also be the more specialized equipment, like the Kevlar if you're working in a facility, or flame retardant coveralls. It can be those sorts of activities. So again, it's the activity that occurs before the beginning of the workday that is required to do the job. And sometimes that can be compensable under the law.
And when manufacturers try to solve this problem of requiring employees to wear certain types of clothing or gear to perform their job, but not make the changing time compensable time, how do they go about that?
One of the common strategies is to allow certain items to go home with the employee. And the Department of Labor at the federal level has had a position that if the employee is allowed to change those items at home, the time spent doing that is not going to be compensable. So that's one strategy that some employers have utilized. A second one is to rearrange the way the workday starts and have people clock in and then maybe put on and take off those items in the work area on paid time.
Right. In fact, maybe the required items could be located near the workstation so that if there is a several minute walk through the factory, the walk is performed before any of the required gear changing is done. If you do it in reverse and the clothes or the gear is donned up at the front of the facility and then there's a 2 or 3 minute walk, the argument in a lawsuit might be that the walk time has to be compensable because the continuous workday started with that first activity up front at the front end of the factory. I'd also like to comment on some of the employers that, for sanitary reasons, don't want to provide the flexibility of changing at home. And I've seen some employers in that circumstance rearrange the activities in a smart way to minimize how much time is spent on the donning and doffing. For example, I've seen employers change their requirements from wearing the sanitary pants and a sanitary shirt and require employees to change into and out of those to instead use a smock that can slip on over their the employee's street clothes. And the smock with maybe 3 or 4 snaps in the front could take all of 15 seconds or less to don every morning. And that can be done after clocking in, going on paid time, and maybe walking down the hallway from the time clock into the production area. So with a little bit of thought, I've seen employers minimize the amount of time that is being paid for donning and doffing time in those cases where they do want to require that it happen in the facility for sanitary or other quality purposes.
That's exactly right. And there's another concept I'll throw out here. It's that employers do have the option of collectively bargaining about this issue if they do have a union presence to make some of this time non-compensable, at least at the federal level. Keep in mind, we mentioned the state nuances that can and do exist, and some states say you can't collectively bargain over that issue. Keep that in mind. If you do have a union, you can sometimes bargain these issues with the union to render the time non-compensable if it otherwise would be.
Yeah, and for our listeners that like to have a statutory site, that's Section 203(o) of the Fair Labor Standards Act. And it talks about you don't have to count as compensable hours work time spent changing into and out of clothes if that's pursuant to a labor contract or even a custom and practice under a labor contract, even if you don't have specific language in your labor contract. So that's an item that can be put on the bargaining table typically and handled, at least the federal law issue, as you pointed out, Keith. Let me shift gears and talk about meal and rest breaks, because I know that in most manufacturing environments, it's perfectly common to have standard break times, have standard meal periods. Employers often want to treat some of those as not paid time. And so what are the issues that the manufacturer will face in that regard?
I think the most surprising thing when I'm talking to employers about rest and meal breaks at the federal level is to know that you don't have to provide a rest or a meal break, at least not pursuant to the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, to your point. But the issue comes in if you want to provide a meal period that is unpaid. And that's one of the exceptions to the continuous workday rule we talked about. If you have a bona fide break during the workday, that time can be unpaid. But to be bona fide under the federal law, it typically should be 30 minutes, sometimes as few as 20 minutes, during which the employees are completely relieved of all duty. At the federal level, they don't have to be allowed to leave the premises. So you can have them taking their breaks in the parking lot or in the break room and still make it unpaid at the federal level. But again, it should be 20 to 30 minutes long, during which they're completely relieved of all duty.
Yeah, but that can be different under state wage law. And right here in our home state of Wisconsin, we have a good example. Our state law says that for the meal period to be properly treated as unpaid, it has to not only be 30 minutes in duration, but during that time, the employee has to be entirely free of work duties and free to leave the premises. So if people want to get in the car and go through the drive-through for lunch or really anything on their free time, they have to be allowed to do that.
That's exactly right. Yep, no captive meal periods under state law here in the state of Wisconsin. Now, that's a little nuance. Another thing to keep in mind at the state level is that certain states will require you to provide a rest break or a meal break. And it's not a matter of whether it's paid or not. It's whether you provide it to the employees. And California is one great example where you do have to provide meal periods and rest breaks to your employees if they work a certain number of hours in the day.
And it would take more than one podcast to talk about California wage law on meal and rest breaks. But the one comment I'd like to make about those is I'm reminded by your comment on the Fair Labor Standards Act labor contract exemption. And that is under the California law that does require meal and rest breaks. There's an opportunity for employers that have a union relationship to gain an exemption under the California law if your labor contract handles the issues and it meets other certain requirements that are beyond the scope of this podcast. You can always check with your favorite Ogletree, California lawyer for the specifics in that regard. And so with that, Keith, I'd like to wrap up this part one of our podcasting on wage and hour issues for manufacturers and invite everyone to watch for our additional podcasts on this topic. Next up, we'll cover overtime issues, which is really the heart and soul of wage and hour litigation. And we're going to address the particular overtime issues faced by manufacturers when they get caught up in wage and hour litigation. Will you join me for that one?
I'm looking forward to it, bud. Thank you.
All right. And thank you for sharing your wage and hour expertise. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And we look forward to future Ogletree podcasts. Have a great day.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.